Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Before we start this week's episode of Earth Eats, a request. Go to the website, eartheats.org, click the red Give Now button, select WFIU Public Radio, and support Earth Eats. Your contribution will help keep our weekly show going strong. And the website, and the Twitter feed, and news stories, and recipes. Whether it's $5 a month or $5 per show, every supporter means so much. This is one of two times a year we ask for listener support. So get on it today. EarthEats.org. Thanks. Okay, here's the show.
When we would do a few wholesales, we were getting pretty much just a conventional rate for that product, even though it was a higher quality product because it was indeed organic.
Candace Minster of the White Violet Center for Eco-Justice. She talks about the dollars and cents behind the farm's decision to get USDA certified organic. From Harvest Public Media, some see food waste as trash. Others see it as a business opportunity. Ranchers debate how much of their money should go toward promoting beef to American consumers. And vegetarian recipes with Daniel Orr both feature millet. One is a salad and the other is a cake for birds. Mark Chilla picked four stories from the week's food headlines for us.
The Food and Drug Administration this week introduced stricter rules on cleaning and refrigeration for vehicles that carry food. Refrigerated trucks and rail cars will have to be pre-cooled before loading and temperatures closely tracked while in transit. The rules are part of the Food Safety Modernization Act, a sweeping law passed in 2010 to boost safety and sanitation throughout the food system. Large businesses will have 1 year to get in line with the new regulations, and small businesses will be given 2 years to comply. A watchdog group has released a study showing packaged foods and restaurant meals are only 4% less salty than they were a decade ago. The Center for Science in the Public Interest study tracked sodium content in 500 foods since 2005. Sodium decreased in more than half of the products that still remain on the market, but increased in about a third of those foods. In 2005, the CSPI asked government agencies to set mandatory sodium limits in processed foods. The watchdog sued the FDA last year and in February gave the government until June 1st to respond. White House officials told Politico that voluntary targets on sodium in processed foods would be released as early as this summer. The USDA is estimating that American farmers may plant more corn this summer than they have in years. But with the news that China will begin selling off its huge corn stockpiles, prices could suffer. China announced last week it'll move away from stockpiling corn and start selling its huge inventory. That's more than half of all the world's corn stores. The country had saved up corn as it grew its middle class, putting a priority on food security. Now that growth is slowing down. The U.S. Grains Council said in a statement they were surprised by the timing of the move and will monitor its impact. And there's an almost 50-50 chance there is too much inorganic arsenic in your rice cereal. That's according to a recent risk assessment by the FDA. According to the New York Times, the FDA tested 76 rice cereals for infants and found that 47% contained more arsenic than the current proposed limit of 100 parts per billion. That's the same limit the European Union proposed last year. This is the first time the FDA is proposing regulating inorganic arsenic in foods, despite concerns expressed by researchers and public health advocates for years. Arsenic is an organic substance that is naturally distributed in the Earth's crust. But inorganic arsenic, meaning it contains no carbon atoms, comes from the use of fertilizers and pesticides containing arsenic. Arsenic has been outlawed in pesticides since the 1980s, but because it doesn't break down like some other toxins, it routinely ends up in our food and drinking water. In a statement, the FDA did not suggest that parents and pregnant women avoid rice altogether, but rather suggested that they vary the types of cereals consumed to include oats and barley. See both short news stories and in-depth features posted on our website, eartheats.org.
Twitter gives you quick updates 24/7. Find us at Earth Eats. Mark Chilla. Always good to hear from you.
Anytime.
Americans are buying less beef. That's why some ranchers want to pay for more ads to boost sales. But that has ignited a food fight in cattle country. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted walks us through the issues.
Charles Bassett wants you to buy hamburgers made from his Missouri cows. That's why he's in favor of paying an extra dollar every time he sells one of his cattle. It's called a checkoff program, and it's like a tax. The money collected would be spent on promoting Missouri beef.
Me, myself, as an individual producer, as hard as I work, do the best job I can do, I don't have time to leave my operation and go promote my product. I just don't have.
Bassett, like all U.S. beef producers, already pays for a federal checkoff. Remember the famous beef commercial?
You can have a great beef dinner in no time at all. Well, almost no time at all. Beef. It's what's for dinner.
That was made with checkoff money. But Bassett says the federal checkoff money doesn't go far enough to promote his beef. Adding a state checkoff would help.
And by pooling my resources with other producers in Missouri, we're able to have a full-time staff working for us every day promoting our product.
Bassett, who runs a commercial cow-calf operation in Missouri's Pulaski County, says the money raised from the state checkoff would be used to drum up demand for Missouri beef. Iowa and Oklahoma are eyeing the option, too. In all, 14 states, including Illinois, already have their own state checkoffs on the books. North Dakota added one in 2015.
We want to stay competitive with our consumers and against our competing protein products out there.
Nancy Jo Bateman is the executive director for the North Dakota Beef Commission, which is in charge of the checkoff money.
What the beef industry has seen over the last 30-some years is that, since the national checkoff started, is that our buying power for programs that help to increase demand for beef has been shrinking dramatically.
With state checkoff money, the commission bought up primetime TV space. In North Dakota, that means the state high school basketball tournament.
Putting things in motion.
One TV spot promotes the role producers play in the North Dakota food system, while images of cows and juicy steaks flash on screen.
North Dakota's farmers and ranchers deliver. Agriculture touches all our lives every day.
These ads are more important than ever, according to many beef producers, because Americans are buying less beef. We're buying a lot more chicken. To combat that, cattle ranchers want the checkoff funds to go towards studying the health benefits of beef and how to lower production costs. But the checkoffs are controversial. Some ranchers say the funds aren't transparent enough, and some feel their money isn't always directed to the right place. Gary Williams is a professor of economics at Texas A&M University.
There are concerns often by state-level groups that the national organization may not be spending or doing what would benefit that state the most, and they'll add a state checkoff.
Williams says research shows checkoff programs can be slightly effective, but there are so many other variables that affect demand.
Foreign demand and, you know, oil problems and wars and weather and all these other things have a whole lot more effect on demand than promotion does. It's a statistically significant impact, but it's relatively small.
Ranchers in California decided against adding a state checkoff in 2012. Some beef producers in Missouri agree.
My name is Roger Allison. I'm a family farmer from Howard County, Missouri.
Well, this cow here, number 31, has had a number of calves, and she's an older cow. But you have another calf or two.
Allison says another reason ranchers oppose a state checkoff is that it's a venue for large commercial operations to control promotion at the expense of small farmers.
Once they get the money, all of a sudden, you know, they feel like they've got the control over beef producers in this state.
Ultimately, Missouri farmers will vote in April on whether to add the checkoff. What they decide will help shape the beef industry's modern evolution. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
The USDA announced new data this week about the growing number of organic farms around the country. There are almost now 22,000 organic operations, thanks in part to a 12% bump last year. Indiana added 81 organic farms in 2015. The White Violet Center for Eco-Justice is one of those new organic farms. Its 5 acres on the campus of St. Mary of the Woods in West Central Indiana is a ministry of the Sisters of Providence. I spoke with garden manager Candace Minster last year as they were starting to sell their first batch of USDA-certified organic produce. She recalled that stressful day when the inspector visited the farm.
Yeah, I was worked up getting to it. I wanted to have everything in order, but I think I was so nervous because I just had no idea what to expect.
This was a new experience for Minster, but the gardens had been certified before. Sister Ann Sullivan founded the White Violet Center in 1996. She herself grew up on an organic farm. Sullivan reclaimed the land from the local family who had been farming it, and making that land certified organic was just in line with the mission of the center.
But also the concern was that at the time, the sisters' water that they would drink, it was from their own wells, and some of the farm chemicals that were used on the land were ending up in their wells and in their drinking water.
So it was both a human and an environmental health concern. Over the next 12 years, they sold most of the harvest at the Terre Haute Farmers Market and through their community-supported agriculture program. They realized that the USDA certification didn't mean much to their customers.
But a lot of consumers were saying things like, oh, I trust you, or oh, I know you don't use any chemicals out there. And so it didn't seem like the seal of certified organic was the most important thing.
They surrendered the organic certification in 2008. It was a cost-saving decision, too. But nothing changed about how they actually grew the food. Same organic techniques without the requirement to take detailed notes on everything happening on the farm. On the marketplace side, one thing they did notice was a change in the price they received for their food on the wholesale market.
When you are selling your organically grown produce wholesale, you need to be able to prove that you are indeed using organic methods in order for a buyer to pay that organic premium. When we would do a few wholesales, we were getting pretty much just a conventional rate for that product, even though it was a higher quality product because it was indeed organic.
There was a convergence of things that were happening at once that caused us to reexamine organic certification.
That's Lori Heber, director of the White Violet Center. She says they noticed an increase in wholesale options for organics. Walmart and Kroger could be customers, she said. Another important factor, the USDA introduced its organic certification cost share programs in 2015.
So that's brought the cost of obtaining an organic certification down tremendously. So for instance, our certification process cost us just under $1,000, and the USDA will reimburse us up to $750 of that. So it makes it an affordable option.
They started the ball rolling in September 2014 by meeting with a rep from a certifying agency. Minster then spent much of the next couple months pulling together an organic systems plan.
That is a fancy way of saying the certifying agencies and the USDA want to learn about how you farm. They want to know what it is you're planting, what kinds of amendments you might be using. It feels a little daunting when you first look at all the documents that you're asked to complete.
Luckily, she'd kept detailed notes on the farming operation, so she already had much of the information she needed on hand. In fact, when the inspector came to visit that day, he complimented White Violet on their record keeping. Their first USDA-certified organic produce was sold in May of last year. Minster and Heber hope it will help them stand out in an increasingly crowded market. They're having different conversations now with customers.
Some of our customers at the farmers market and even some of our CSA members, as they say, oh, you're certified now? And there's a little bit of a question mark at the end of their statement. And as I have emphasized, our growing practices never changed. Even though we voluntarily surrendered our certification in 2008, all of our practices were still basically as though we were certified. Some of the bits of paperwork and record keeping did relax because we didn't have someone wanting to look at our compost temperature logs, for instance.
Candace Minster is the garden manager of the USDA Certified Organic White Violet Center for Ecojustice. Lori Heber is the director. We've got pictures of the beautiful gardens on our website and lots of great organic gardening advice. EarthEats.org. A preview of what we'll be cooking with Daniel Orr.
Millet is a granule. A lot of times people think of it as bird food because you'll actually see it in bags of bird food, and it's the stuff that the birds don't even eat. So usually it's the stuff that the cardinals push to the ground around the bird feeder. But when they are super hungry and they need nourishment and sustenance, they eat the millet.
You're not really selling this recipe, Chef.
But I call this Happy Mouth Millet Salad. So this is going to make your mouth happy.
That recipe and then a chef's version of bird food sounds good enough for humans to eat, but that's not recommended. Ready to go into the kitchen next. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Name that grain. Couscous?
Nope.
Millet? Millet! All right.
Got a prize winner.
Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
All right. Are we ready to roll? Here we go. Millet, one of the things that people kind of find it hard about it is that it can get pasty. So what I do is I toast it first in a wide-bottomed, narrow-sided pan, toast it until it's just starting to get toasty and brown. Then I add my liquid, cook it until it's tender enough to the tooth. That's got good texture. After you cook it, then rinse it really well. That's what we've done here. I've put it in a chinois, which is a strainer, and drained all the excess liquid out of it. Okay, so we've got the millet. Now we're going to make it happy by adding these other ingredients. I'm going to add a half cup of toasted walnuts. I'm using the English walnuts, which are the more traditional. You could use black walnuts as well. Then we have another ingredient that's very, very trendy now. It's goji berries. They're kind of like a raisin. They're orangey red in color, about a quarter of an inch long, and they've got kind of a sweet tart flavor to them. So they're great in salads. You can put them into stir fries. We're also going to continue with that kind of sweet sour flavor with some apple, and we're just going to dice it up and dice it about the same size as the goji berries. So the millet having that, you know, kind of texture to it, we want to add some crunchy ingredients, so that's why we're doing the apple and the goji berries and the walnuts. Okay, now we're going to do my herbs, which we love to do. So again, rough chopped herbs. In this case, I'm using cilantro. And don't be afraid of the stems. Cilantro stems, you pay just as much for those as the rest of the herbs. A little bit of scallion. A little of that onion flavor is good in most dishes, too. Scallions, chives, leeks. Okay, adding a little bit of lemon zest, olive oil, and lemon juice. This is my go-to dressing, is just olive oil and lemon juice. Keep it simple. Salt and pepper. And I forgot one ingredient, which is the cucumber. The cucumber is going to give this dish that kind of watery crunch that's going to make it very refreshing and light. And we've got the Happy Mouth Millet Salad.
There are a lot of substitutions you can make in this recipe. We've called it the Mix and Match Millet Salad. It's at eartheats.org. Food waste is an expensive problem. The average U.S. family puts a couple thousand dollars worth of food in the garbage every year. But what some see as a problem, others see as a business opportunity. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon reports on the promises and limitations of a technology that pledges to turn wasted food into electricity.
What do you get when you combine spoiled milk, cattle manure, vats of grease, and helpful bacteria into a massive tank? You get an anaerobic digester facility, and this is one in rural Weld County in northeastern Colorado.
Welcome to Heartland Biogas.
This is my tour guide, Scott Pexton.
Thanks. It certainly smells like we're in the right place.
Yeah. There's a lot of good smell around here.
The place stinks. A mix of cow poop and expired produce. Pexton works for a composting company, A1 Organics, which runs the food waste portion of this plant. We're standing in front of six huge cream-colored holding tanks.
The microbes in there, they want to keep them healthy and happy. And so that they, when they're healthy, they make methane gas, and they make a lot of it.
The tanks work like an enormous stomach. In goes the food waste.
We've got summer squash and citrus and pineapples. I mean, anything you'd see in a grocery store.
And just like your own digestive system, what comes out is a liquid, a solid used for composting, and a gas. And that's what they really want, the methane gas. It's captured and sent into a pipeline and used to generate electricity. Pexton says if this food was thrown out, it'd be sending all that gas into the air.
This rots in a landfill, and rotting food in a landfill makes methane gas, but it's an uncontrolled process.
Pexton says anaerobic digesters like this one solve a few problems at once. They generate renewable energy, divert food waste from landfills, cut down on harmful emissions, and provide a few jobs along the way.
So we've seen a lot of those types of digesters in Europe.
That's Darby Hoover with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
And we're just starting to really see them emerge in the U.S.
Hoover says anaerobic digestion is one promising piece of a much larger puzzle to solve the food waste problem. But digesters are expensive, and typically cities pay for waste management for their residents.
With an anaerobic digester, you often have high project costs up front. Cities may not see that there's a high value to implementing something like a digester.
Then there's the fact that facilities like this don't attack the root of the food waste problem. We as consumers throw out a staggering amount of food every year. Digesters are simply big machines that can swallow and digest the food we don't eat.
There's definitely opportunities to focus on reducing the waste in the first place.
That's Virginia Till, a recycling expert with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. The federal government put out the country's first ever food waste reduction goals last year. They call for us to cut our food waste in half by 2030. Making renewable energy from food that can't be eaten is admirable, Till says. But the best thing to do with wasted food is to feed people. Almost one in seven U.S. households are food insecure, unsure of where their next meal is coming from.
And so that fact, coupled with the fact that we waste about a third of our food that's produced, those two facts together get me up in the morning.
Back at the digester in rural Colorado, composter Scott Pexton agrees. Even if people stop throwing out perfectly good food, you'll still have the banana peel.
And we still certainly believe in the whole idea of reduce first. Once the reducing is done, then we take care of it from there on out.
We wasted more than 130 billion pounds of food in the U.S. last year, and most of that just sits in landfills.
I would have to say sustainability is more expensive. It is. It costs more to recycle things rather than to just send them all to one place.
It's more expensive now, but if wasted food is ignored and left to rot, the future could be even more costly. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
¶¶
Watch a video that goes with this story at harvestpublicmedia.org. All right, more millet. This time it's part of your run-of-the-mill bird seed. We're making suet cakes for the birds. Daniel says his cardinals and robins and woodpeckers don't seem to like the millet so much. And who can really blame them when you consider all the delicious ingredients that are part of this?
It's no bake, so it's the easiest thing possible. I've got some lard right here. Then we're going to add some peanut butter, which adds a nice richness, and the aroma really gets the birds wanting to come to your backyard. And we're just going to mix those two ingredients together until it forms a smooth paste. If your lard is really hard, you might want to melt it over the stovetop to get it going. But it almost is going to look like a icing or a peanut butter cookie mixture. And then we're just going to mix in all the other little grains. We've got some cornmeal. We've got some wonderful rolled oats. We've got some bird seed, which I have millet and sunflower seeds. Then we're going to, for those birds that have a sweet tooth, we're going to add some raisins. I'm using some white raisins, but you could use any type of dried fruit or currants. Or even if you have a grapevine in your backyard, you could pick off the dried grapes and mix those right into your little suet cake for your birds. You're just going to mix to incorporate those. But you want to have a nice sturdy cake, because when the sun hits it, you don't want it to just melt and roll down your tree. A little bit of just white flour, which is going to be a really good binder for it. And a funny thing is that we're going to add some cayenne pepper. They love chilies. And there's even the Thai bird peppers, which are named bird peppers because the birds just love them, and they're one of the hottest peppers you can get. And that's the way that chili peppers spread their seed, is by having birds eat them and then deposit them all around other neighborhoods. And so we just make this into a really nice thick cake. Okay, and then we just have some molds. What I've done is I've put a little bit, you could take a cat food can or any kind of little tin or a hummus container. Just put it, have it cleaned out, rub a little bit of water inside, and then you push your plastic wrap in there, and it will stick to the water that you put inside there. So then I've spread these evenly inside. And then what we do is we take that, we put it in the freezer, let it firm up, and then you can just kind of tap them out once they're frozen. You've got these wonderful little cakes. And then you could nail these to a tree, and hopefully you'll have a lot of visitors to your birdseed table.
Daniel Orr is a busy man at Farm Bloomington Restaurant. Thanks to him for all the recipes. Thanks also to Aabon Binder, Mark Chilla, and Betsy Shepherd for keeping eartheats.org in order. And Chad Bouchard and Taylor Killow write for the blog. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Support also comes from folks like you. Right now, we're collecting names to add to our list of supporters. Take a moment to visit eartheats.org. Click the red Give Now button in the upper right. Drop a couple bucks in the hat to support stories about food and farming and local living. And thank you. I'm Annie Corrigan. Till next time.